good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Wednesday, middle of the week, December 27th, 2017. 12 minutes past the hour, can you believe it? We only have, 5 days left in 2017. Another year has blown by. We have a great guest this hour who really fits this time of year as we're getting ready to ring in the new year. But before we get to our guest, I want to give you some programming notes. Coming up here Friday on WWGH Radio, December 29th at 4:10 p.m., WWGH Special, WWGH Remembers. What this is people who I've had on over the years who we lost in 2017. That special will be hosted and produced by Adam Lepp. People on that special: Monty Hall, Robert Guillaume, Liz Smith, Dick Gregory, Professor Irwin Corey, Judge Joseph Wapner, and the Reverend Leroy Jenkins. That'll be Friday at 4:10. December 29th. Now, Friday at 5:10 p.m., we'll have another special produced and hosted by Adam Lepp, the Best of the Now program, the program that you're listening to, the best guest from the year of 2017, 5:10 on Friday, December 29th. That includes former candidate for president Michael Dukakis, Bob Barker, Charles Grodin, Dick Cavett, Pat Carroll, Phil Donahue, Wally Amos, President Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt's granddaughter, Eleanor Roosevelt Seagraves, Ed Asner, and Dick Gregory. That'll be Friday, December 29th at 5:10 p.m. Now, coming up tomorrow here on the program, with New Year's just around the corner, the number one New Year's resolution is to lose weight. So tomorrow, to help us with that, at 12:10, we will have former doctor from the Today Show and Good Morning America, Dr. Art Uhlein, will be on tomorrow to give you some tips on losing weight in the new year. And tomorrow at 1:10, we will be joined by former HBO boxing analyst Larry Merchant, who will help us remember the year in sports and in news. That's tomorrow, Thursday. Now, this hour is going to be a lot of fun, because before Ryan Seacrest, before Dick Clark, the man, the original Mr. New Year's Eve, was Guy Lombardo. Guy Lombardo and his big band remotes were the first broadcast nationwide of the New Year's Eve holiday. This happened in 1929. They started in 1929 on radio. His orchestra played at the Roosevelt Grill in the Roosevelt Hotel in New York from 1929 to 1959. By that point, it was also on CBS television. And from 1959 to 1976, the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. Now, he was Mr. New Year's Eve. Today, we are going to be joined by his niece, Gina Lombardo, who attended those events at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York from 1960 until 1976. But before we do that, for those of you who don't remember, here is a little clip of the introduction the last year Guy Lombardo did it on CBS, 1976. And away we go here on WWGH Radio.
Time for the 48th annual broadcast of New Year's Eve with Guy Lombardo. Tonight's special guest stars are Billy Eckstein and Carol Lawrence, and at Times Square, Ben Grauer. And now, from the world-famous Waldorf Astoria Hotel on fashionable Park Avenue, where New York's glamorous high society is celebrating New Year's Eve in the Grand Ballroom, it's the Royal Canadians and Mr. New Year's Eve himself, Guy Lombardo.
Well, folks, thank you very much, and welcome to our New Year's Eve party. Not only do you folks here in the Waldorf Astoria, but all of you looking in on CBS all over this nation and the Canadian great TV stations, too. I will get our dancing underway, and our first number is Babyface.
now somebody who was in the room that night happened, Guy Lombardo's niece, Gina Lombardo. Gina, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Doing well. So glad to be able to catch up with you. Before we get to New Year's Eve, tell people how you're related to Guy. Whose daughter are you? How did...
Guy was my uncle. My father was Liebert Lombardo, who was the trumpet player in the orchestra. That's basically it, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, there were four brothers?
Actually, there were five brothers and two sisters, but four were in the orchestra.
How did this all get started before New Year's Eve, that Guy Lombardo and the family was going to be musically oriented?
It really goes back to my grandfather, Guy Lombardo Sr. You would say he was probably a frustrated musician. He was a baritone singer, and he just had a love and admiration for all things musical. And so his children were all going to play an instrument. And they used to come on their way home from school, would stop in his tailor. He was a tailor in London. And they would stop in his shop and practice their instruments. They did, my grandmother belonged to a ladies' club, and they would do the little trio. It was Carmen. My father started on the drums, not the trumpet. Uncle Carmen on the flute and Guy on the violin, and they would play, the little trio would play for my grandmother's garden club, ladies' club, those type of things, and that's really how it got started.
For people who don't remember, what type of music was it?
Big band music.
And the name of the band was the Royal...
Guy Lombardo and his Royal Canadians.
Royal Canadians. How did that come about?
Basically because they were from London. Everybody, I guess, kind of had like a, you know, everybody had their little, you know, their little name that kind of identified them. They didn't wear the red jackets until probably into the late 50s, early 60s. They always wore tuxedos prior to that. But that was their moniker, as you would say.
When did the band start to become really well known?
Well, you know, you talk about that New Year's Eve 1929. They were broadcast coast to coast on the radio. It was a big deal because that really was something that was very new. And from that point forward, that just catapulted them to, you know, they were in Cleveland, they wound up in Chicago, and finally New York.
1929, how did that come about that they would broadcast New Year's Eve?
You know, they were at the Granada Cafe in Cleveland, and they were broadcasting live on the radio. And I just believe that because they were finally able to do the coast-to-coast type of a relay, that, and they were already broadcasting on the radio. I believe that's how it came about.
Old Ensign, was that from the very start, were they using that?
Yeah, that was kind of their theme song. You know, they were from London, Ontario. There was a lot of, I guess, Scottish influence up there. And that was a very, I guess it was kind of a familiar song for them.
So the first New Year's Eve they broadcast in 1929 was actually from Cleveland.
Yes, it was.
I did not, that's strange. I did not know that. When did they move to New York?
Very shortly after that. They had a short stint in Chicago and then finally came to New York and very quickly found the Roosevelt Hotel and were there for 20 some odd years.
Now, obviously this was before your time, but yeah. How did it become a tradition? Why, after 1929, did it become an annual thing?
I think that, you know, the type of music that they were playing and the crowds that they attracted wanted to celebrate on New Year's Eve, and that was just a very big time. And so it was a very grand event to go see them at any time, but especially if you were fortunate enough to be there on New Year's Eve.
When television came in, what adaptations did they have to make?
Well, you know, that's really the reason why they left the Roosevelt. The ballroom was just too small and was not really could not accommodate the modern cameras. And so that's when they moved down the road over to the Waldorf Astoria. And that was really the big change that they had to make. They, you know, they were very tried and true. On camera, off camera, you always got the same show.
When people went to the Roosevelt, again, before your time, but what was that like? What kind of celebration was going on there?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, the band did a television show for about 10 years that was broadcast from the Roosevelt Hotel. And it was all staged. It wasn't live performance. It was staged performance. But it kind of those films give you a sense of kind of the elegance that even if it wasn't New Year's Eve, you would dress up and you would go to dinner and you would dance. And it was just a lovely linen, you know, tablecloth, linen napkins, silver china, the whole nine yards. And that was kind of the feel when you went to see them.
Now, at the Roosevelt Hotel, at what point did Times Square enter the picture?
You know, that's a really good question. I think it was always kind of a component, and they would count down, but I don't think you had the visuals until the 60s.
When they moved to television, they moved to the Waldorf Astoria.
Mm-hmm.
How big of an event was that? You were there for some of those events. What were those like?
It was really a remarkable time to be there and to see it, especially as a young child. You know, all the ladies dressing up and the men in their tuxedos. But the whole entire hotel, and the Waldorf Astoria is quite large, would basically be focused on this event. And these guests, you know, I don't even remember what the total number of guests. That room would be filled from the dance floor all the way up into the balconies. And it was just spectacular. And they always had stars that would come, Carol Lawrence, all these people would come and sing and do a couple of numbers. And so you knew you were going to see stars, you were going to see famous people perform. It was always just a really wonderful treat, and it was all-encompassing for those moments that you were there.
How did it come about that CBS would broadcast this?
You know, I'm not really sure. That's a very good question. It probably had something to do with their recording label and, you know, the contacts that they had there in New York City.
How early did Guy get to the Waldorf Astoria to get ready for the television broadcast?
Oh, they were there all week. They would come home off the road for Christmas, and so they'd go home. They'd get home maybe a day or two before Christmas Eve. They'd be on the road all. This is how it was when I was a child. And they would come home a couple of days before. We'd have our Christmas celebration, and then they would all go and get rooms at the Waldorf, and rehearsal would be the whole week before. And they wouldn't leave the Waldorf again until, you know, the show was over.
As you said, the family was musically oriented. How did Guy become the lead?
He's the oldest.
Mm.
Very strong Italian family. He's the oldest brother. He's the oldest child.
What kind of guy was he?
He was probably one of the most wonderful people you would ever want to meet. He was generous and kind. He really cared about the communities that he worked in and lived in. He was a great uncle, and, you know, he's missed. They're all missed every day.
Guy Lombardo became synonymous with New Year's Eve. Did he like that?
I think he did. It was, you know, the year was based on the certain things that they did, and the two events in my lifetime that were most significant, obviously, were New Year's Eve and then the Jones Beach productions that they did every summer out on Long Island. And those were the otherwise they were doing one-nighters, which, you know, honestly, they loved going around the country. They loved the people that were their fans, and they loved to go from town to town. But as the years wore on, it got pretty exhausting. And so they had these two events that they knew they would come home, and they would be home for an extended period of time. And they were pretty significant events in the year.
He did this event 47 years, starting on radio,
yeah.
47 New Year's Eves. I don't think anybody will break that record. Certainly nobody has broken that. By the end, he was in his mid-70s that last New Year's.
When he died, he was 76.
76, so he was 75 the last year.
So 75, yeah, and he died in 77. So he was 76 when he died. So the last one he did, he was 70. His birthday was in July. So yeah, he was 75 when he did his last New Year's Eve show.
75 in 1976, and 75 back then was a rather old age in 1970.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was it tough for him at any point?
No.
He still
no. They
it.
Were workhorses, all of them. Carmen, my uncle, who was the first to pass away. He passed away at the age of 69, but he was strong as a bull. He succumbed to stomach cancer. Guy was still strong and very agile and very, very full of energy. He went in for a bypass surgery and developed pneumonia, and that's how he passed. It wasn't because he was frail or weak. And my father had the good fortune to live to be 88. And so they were very strong stock.
As I say, you were there from 60 to 76. What are some of the things that stick out in that 16-year period?
You know, it was always great. My mother was a big proponent of us seeing the world, and so whenever she could, she would take us out of school and we would travel with the band. And so always on the bus, and how it wasn't, you know, even though it was work, it was still family, and it was just really kind of, it was just very unique and very wonderful to kind of be around my uncles and the other men in the band and their wives who traveled with them on the bus, and seeing all the different places in the world, especially the United States. They, in the summer times when Guy, Dad, and Uncle Carmen were home, we would, you know, go to each other's houses like regular family. And people are saying, oh, he's a big celebrity. Yeah, he's a big celebrity, but he was my uncle. And he's like anybody else's uncle. He's a great guy, very warm. All my relatives were very warm, very inviting, and always a joy to be around.
If you went to a Guy Lombardo concert when he was out touring, what did you see? What did you hear?
Boy, you know, the stories that I remember seeing and being told about, just people celebrating their anniversaries and how, you know, since Guy has passed, and when I do meet people and talk to people about it, you know, people who never even heard the music remember their grandparents telling stories about, you know, spending their anniversary dancing to Guy Lombardo at such and such club in such town, and that it was such a big deal that that happened, and how, you know, when you were there, you listened to the music, you listened to Guy, and you saw the people just having a very, very good time.
There were other people involved in the production. Do you know how the music was chosen for New Year's Eve?
You mean the different songs that they played?
Yeah.
That would have been between Larry Owen, my Uncle Guy, probably my Uncle Kenny Gardner. They would discuss, you know, the arrangements that they'd been playing on the road, because, you know, they were playing this all year. And so either they were going to bring in a new song, introduce a new song, or they were just going to continue on with the songs that they were playing in their working library at that time.
As we said, the last New Year's that Guy did for CBS television before he passed away was 1976. You, 75 going into 70, or 76.
No, 76 going into 77.
Yeah, 76 going into 77. And we have a little audio of that. You were in the room. Let's go back. Guy Lombardo, this is the last, I think, minute and a half of 1976, so here we go.
To Times Square and Ben Drower to see the excitement over there. Take it away, Ben.
Take it away? Oh, I hope I can talk. I just saw the sign up there and it said 15 degrees. This is the coldest New Year's Eve I've ever covered in almost 40 years. Slowly, it's time. It's just so that when it hits the bottom, it'll be the New Year. And that's what the moment that everyone that's gathered here is waiting for. Slowly it's starting to move. Listen to the crowd. Listen to this surge of hope for the new year that's coming as we greet it in traditional fashion in Times Square, New York. More, more. Come in, come in, come in.
Now, what was that night like?
It was really a lot of fun. I was there with a couple of my friends from high school, and it was one of the first times, you know, we as, you know, 16, 17-year-olds were really allowed to dress up and really fully partake in the evening, and we just were, you know, on the dance floor and just so excited, and it was just really, and then looking at all the fun people and, you know, always trying to find out which camera's on and taking pictures of the crowd at that moment, and all the, you know, the great people and all the characters that were there year after year that, you know, would mug for the camera. It was just a fun, you know, just a fun event.
What was Guy Lombardo's relationship with Ben Brower?
Ben Brower, he was just the announcer or the reporter from CBS. I mean, they all knew each other. It was a much smaller world back then, and they all knew each other. But I don't know, you know, really any personal relationship between the two of them.
I know a few years before Guy passed away, Dick Clark had started his New Year's Eve special over at ABC, and Dick Clark was down in Times Square. Was there ever any thought given to Guy moving down to Times Square?
No. You know, Guy, you know, he really kind of always saw the writing on the wall about the rock and roll, and that wasn't something that they were going to really kind of step into. They played a couple of Jim Croce songs and that kind of stuff to kind of modernize their library, but that wasn't who they were. And he, you know, Guy was very blessed all of his years, the family was, to have such a wonderful fan following, and he just always felt that, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it. I know that that's not always the best motto, but, you know, they really believed in, you know, that their audience knew what they wanted, and they wanted to give it to them.
You know, correct me if I'm wrong, we were talking around the station this morning, but with Guy starting in 1929, even though it did end up on television and the jackets came in and the cameras and the change of room, really, Guy Lombardo is doing a radio New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Dick Clark, I think, was doing a visual. That's why I think he was there in the cold weather and so on and so forth. So I think that was just the main difference.
There was the main difference. And in those days, and again, I never watched it back then, but, you know, now you've got your pseudo live acts that perform and all that. I don't even know if they did that so much as that, you know, they would, you know, just do video clips of performers somewhere and those type of things where, you know, it was just completely different. So I don't even think I really, really felt that it was a threat or an issue, you know, that there was enough audience out there for both.
What did he think anything of it being? I think it started in 72. Dick Clark did. I mean, the guy was known as Mr. New Year's Eve, and I think the ratings lasted for the years Guy was there beating Dick Clark. But did he like that somebody was kind of after all these years on his turf?
No, I don't think he saw it that way. You know, I really don't think he did. Obviously, you know, I mean, he was a very brilliant businessman, and so I'm sure that, you know, it was discussed and it was talked about amongst my father and my uncles, but it was never anything that really was brought to any of our attention.
You talked about the red jackets. What did the red jackets signify?
The Royal Canadians.
Oh, that.
The Mounted Police, yeah.
When Guy passed away, he passed away, 1 month prior to New Year's?
He passed away in November of 77.
What, that had to, because the show, I'm sure, was booked and ready to go.
Yeah.
What was that period like in 77?
It was a very difficult time for everyone in our family. My father, who was at that moment, because my Uncle Victor had gone on and had his solo, my Uncle Victor had his own band. And so my dad was the only brother remaining in the orchestra, and so it fell to him. And my father was always the one that wanted to just stand up, play his trumpet, and sit down. He didn't like being at the microphone. That wasn't his thing. We asked my Uncle Victor to come back, and my brother Bill, who had been in the band for a short time as the drummer, he came back and played the drums to support my father. But it was a very, very difficult time for the entire family. It was unexpected. Guy had had heart surgery before with Michael DeBakey, and none of us, you know, I mean, obviously he's having major surgery, but none of us thought that he wasn't going to be back. And for him to not survive, and it was sudden and very unexpected.
Being that it was so unexpected and that time of year that he was getting ready to do his big program, mm-hmm. What was the media attention around it like?
You know, in those days, the media was a lot kinder and a lot gentler, and they were very respectful of you know, the family and the grieving that we were going on, that was going on in the family at that time. You know, there was speculation, I suppose, but, you know, we just kind of did what the family's always done. We just kind of kept moving forward.
50 days before New Year's, Guy passes away. What was that time period like, just as far as we've got a you know, we're mourning our relative here, and yeah, we've got to go on and do a show in front of a huge audience. What was the room like in 77?
The room was a little bittersweet. People really wanted to, I think there was the idea that they wanted to pay tribute to Guy. You know, and I'm just kind of putting my own memories out there, and that, you know, it wasn't going to be a sad thing. It was going to be a joyful thing, and it was kind of like the culmination of all the years that he did it. And I think everybody kind of had that kind of feeling about it, that they wanted it to be good. Guy wasn't going to be there, but we had to make it as strong and as good as we possibly could for him.
What was the idea after Guy passed about the relationship with CBS? Was there ever any thought to trying to do something else with the orchestra?
No, you know, really, at that point, I think, you know, very very pragmatic people, my father and my the rest of the family, and they just really realized that, you know, even though the music, Guy didn't play every instrument, it really was Guy that people were turning to. And, you know, one of the family sayings is, you know, you need to kind of get off the stage before you're asked to get off the stage, type of a thing. And I think they just really wanted it so that when everybody thought back and remembered New Year's, that they remembered it the way it was.
Now, there were some stories a few years ago that you and your family members own the music and things of that nature.
Yes.
And they're in storage units, and that they were going to be given to some colleges, and something happened. What has happened to all the memorabilia?
Well, we're still kind of in a holding pattern. I've been talking to the University of Colorado. They've got a wonderful music department, and the capability of archiving and scanning and making the music library available to anybody who wants to see it. And, you know, but as universities are, you know, they've got big, you know, they department heads change and all these things happen. So it's on that track, but it just hasn't come to fruition yet.
What kind of things exist as memorabilia?
Well, you know, it's not so much memorabilia. What it is I have the entire working library of the band from the very first arrangement to the very last. I have all of the films of the television shows. And that's pretty much the bulk. There's other things. There's plaques, there's awards, there's those type of things. But really, from the things that are absolutely purposeful and meaningful, it's the music library and the films. Now, the films have already been archived by the Library of Congress, and so there is a full set there.
In the years after Guy's death, what happened with the band itself as far as touring and performing?
Well, you know, my father was not really... He really kind of lost his desire to want to keep going, because he was devastated when my Uncle Carmen passed, and just it almost knocked him completely out when Guy passed. So after a couple of years of struggling and still doing the one-nighters, he finally decided that he needed to retire. So what we did was he licensed the orchestra, and we've had band leaders, and we still do. Al Pearson has been our band leader now for, gosh, almost 30 years. And, you know, so the band does go around, and it still performs. And it performs, you know, our music the way we played it. And that's how, and my father, and he finally retired and lived out his life down here in Florida. So he probably retired about 82, and he passed in 93.
Guy Lombardo, as you say, was the oldest, but he's the one that people remember, and it didn't go on forever without him. What was it about his personality that stuck out?
You know, he had a wonderful mind, and he really understood, like, the connections between things. And when he spoke at the microphone in between the songs and talked about, you know, maybe he recognized somebody in the dancing on the floor, those type of things, those are the things that really, you know, made him a human being. And I think that really drew people to him.
All these years later, what do you miss most on New Year's Eve?
About New Year's Eve?
Yeah.
Guy Lombardo on the TV.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, ever since I was a little girl, it was, you know, it was, we either watched it on TV or we were there up in the hotel room or down on the floor. And it just doesn't seem, it's just not the same.
A lot of people say that who certainly remember it. What do you miss most about your uncle, Guy Lombardo?
I really kind of, I miss just spending time with him. He was a great uncle. He was always interested in what we were doing in school and what we were thinking about being when we grew up. And he'd always, when they were home in the summer, he'd always bring the tempo and we'd go off to some place and have, you know, take the boat and go have lunch somewhere and go swim at his pool. And, you know, we just, I just kind of miss having that uncle.
What would you say his legacy is?
His legacy, I would say, would be continuity. It would be, just willingness to be who you are and do it so that people really, really appreciate it.
What do you think he would think of New Year's Eve today and how it's televised?
I think he'd be shaking his head, you know, because it's so opulent, it's so kind of over the top in a lot of ways. I mean, I've never seen any of the shows. I kind of just see them on the news when they do the clips, when there's a costume failure or any of those type of things. And I just think it's just so over the top. And I think he would probably just kind of sit back and chuckle a little bit.
When the clock strikes midnight on New Year's Eve, what's your life like now?
I'm usually asleep.
Do you miss that hysteria? Has to be what it was. It has to be such a great memory.
It really is. It's a great memory, and it can't be replaced. There's nothing really that I've been able to find that kind of fills that void of what I've always known. So I just kind of stopped trying.
Does anything even go on at the Waldorf Astoria anymore?
You know, the ballroom is used. I don't know if they do any kind of a New Year's party. They probably don't. You know, and I really haven't been up there in years at this time of year. I know the Roosevelt had been refurbished a couple of years ago, and they have a lot of memorabilia about Guy throughout the hotel, which I really appreciate. People have sent me pictures of it. I just don't think that there's anything on that level.
We talked about it a little bit earlier, and since you were there, certainly for the last few, what was a typical day like? When did they start playing? What time did they get off the stage? How did the night work?
I would say they probably started rehearsing in the morning. Probably like 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. They probably were on the bandstand rehearsing, blocking it, and doing what they needed to do for the camera shots and those type of things on the day of. And I would say, if I remember correctly, if everything went well, they probably stopped rehearsing around 3 o'clock.
And what?
You know, because they had to get ready, they had to have a meal, they had, you know, whatever they needed to do.
And what time did the television program start?
You know, probably by 2 a.m., they would be back up in their hotel rooms.
And what did he have any thoughts on New Year's Eve itself? Did he look forward to it?
I think he did. You know, like I said, I mean, it was always like a goal to get home, to be home. And then it was kind of, here we go again, we got a fresh year in front of us.
So many people remember Guy Lombardo from New Year's Eve, but it's kind of interesting. I was at a collectible shop over the holiday, and I was looking through some records. And any time I do that at a collectible shop, you always see something from Guy Lombardo. He must have sold very well all over.
Yeah, he did.
What do you think it is about that still today people hold on to those?
You know, he was very approachable. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't like a matinee idol or, you know, he was very approachable, and he was a real man. I mean, he broke all those speedboat records. You know, he loved that. He loved boating. He, you know, so he wasn't just a guy on a bandstand. He had a lot of, like when he lived in Freeport, Long Island, and I run into people all the time from Freeport who tell me, oh, yeah, they used to talk to him at the train station, and, you know, they had the best conversations, and, you know, they were invited over to his house, and, you know, he was just that guy.
Did he have a favorite number?
You know, I would have to say probably his favorite, probably the waltzes. I don't know particularly which one I would pick, but I think he liked the waltzes the best.
When New Year's Eve hit, he took over the count. When you're in that room looking up at Guy do that, that's your uncle. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking, thank goodness he's going to help us turn over the year.
Well, you know, it's funny because even today I was telling somebody that you were going to be on the program, and they said it's just not New Year's without Guy Lombardo. And it's interesting because they have specials. We certainly have access to more specials now.
Yeah.
People still play Auld Lang Syne, but it was something about him.
Yeah, you know, somebody said years before he passed that if Guy Lombardo dies, he'll take New Year's Eve with him. And, you know, it feels that way sometimes.
Yeah, I think he did. What would you like to see done with the works? Would you like to see anything done with the material?
Well, you know, I would like to, you know, hope that in music schools that when they're teaching about the big bands, that they do touch upon, because Guy transcended all of them. You know, they kind of came right after Isham Jones, and they went past and through, you know, swing and everything else, and they remained consistent through it all. And so it's a big piece, it's a big chunk of that era that Guy Lombardo was fully present in. And I hope that they teach that, his music, his style. My Uncle Carmen was a prolific songwriter. Some of his songs are still, I mean, obviously his songs are still played today. Return to Me, Seems Like Old Times, Boo Hoo, Sweethearts on Parade. You know, he was prolific in his songwriting. And, you know, I hope that, you know, a couple of people, John Pizzarelli covered Coquette, and a couple other people have done some songs, and because it's beautiful music. And my wish is that the younger generation would kind of find it and maybe do some sampling, I guess, how they do now, and, you know, in some of the newer music, because I think it could very easily work into that type of a thing.
Guy Lombardo, there was just something about it. I was even watching that clip this morning, and it's so nice how he handled it. He just had control of that room. How many people would you say were in the room at the Waldorf?
Oh, boy, I want to say there was at least 500 people.
Who were his friends in the show business world?
You know, I would say probably anybody he met, but, you know, they all had their different friends. Louis Armstrong was a dear family friend for many years until his passing. You know, Guy was very good friends with a lot of different people. He was friends with Robert Moses, who was a New York politician who actually created the parkway systems there in New York, and because, you know, they dealt with the state a lot of performances at Jones Beach. But you name it, you know, the guy around the corner who has a marina and he'd pull his boat into, that guy's his buddy too. I mean, that's who he was. He was friends with everybody he met.
He also did some other things, television programs, radio programs. Yeah. Did he like doing those?
Yeah, I think he did. He did an Ellery Queen, which is an old show. He did that one time. I remember how excited he was about that, kind of being on TV. But, you know, they did movies back in, you know, back a long time ago. There was Stage Door Canteen. They were in that. They were in No Leave, No Love with Van Johnson. And there was another one. And those are the days when big bands, the whole band would be in the movie. And so, you know, that was kind of fun. They enjoyed that a bit, too. So, yeah, they did it all.
Yeah, they certainly did. And that it keeps on going is a great thing. 100 years from now, because he will still be mentioned as the first person who did this in 1929, how do you think people will look back on him?
I'm hoping they look back on it and say, wow, you know, what a feat. Because, you know, that was a big deal then. And with technology as I can't even imagine what it'll be like in the future, that was a significant event in technology. Not just in the music business, but in technology too. And so I hope that they'll look back on it and say, wow, he was a pioneer.
Did he like television? I'm thinking 1976, they've got the suits on, they're in the Waldorf Astoria, there's got to be cameras everywhere in that room. Did he like that part of it?
I think that he really didn't see the cameras, you know. I think, and, you know, from all of the times that I've spent traveling with them and going to the different shows, the concerts and everything else, he never changed. If he was on television or if he was just in front of a live audience, he was very comfortable up on that stage. He owned that stage, and he was just happy to be there. It didn't make a difference if it was televised or not.
What do you think are the differences between performers today who are well-known and performances of that era?
Well, you know, I think that the big difference is that there's so many famous people now. You know, and there's so many different venues for them to become famous. You know, some people might say they you know, didn't earn, you know, didn't do their time. I don't agree with that. I think he would be thrilled. I think he'd be absolutely thrilled that there's so many venues and avenues for people to go at their creativity. How he'd feel about, you know, he wasn't a big fan of rock and roll, but he didn't hate it. I don't know how he'd feel about rap and all these other type of music genres. I think he probably would have come around to them eventually, because that's kind of like the way his brain and his heart worked. But I think he'd be thrilled that there's so many venues and avenues for people to be on the stage.
As you said, he passed away unexpectedly. He was in his mid-70s, though. You said he saw the writing on the wall. How long do you think he would have kept doing that? New Year's Eve.
Knowing him and knowing my family, I think he probably would have kept doing it, first of all, as long as his body held out, because they were not the type of people. I never in my entire life, first of all, they never spoke about going to work, because they didn't work. This is just what they did. And I never heard the word retirement. I never heard one of them say they were going to retire. So I don't think that that was even a concept for them. I think they were just going to work until they couldn't work anymore. And I think he probably would have, you know, if the crowds had gotten to the point where it didn't make sense to do the one-nighters and those type of things, he would have pulled back on that probably rather quickly, because that was their least favorite thing to do, was the traveling between towns.
When you were there at those years, 1960 to 1976, is there a year or a memory that sticks out in your mind? Something funny maybe that happened, or just something that you remember well?
Well, you know, gosh, there's so many. A lot of my memories are at Jones Beach, and we really, you know, as a family, we spent a lot of time there in the evenings. The shows went from Memorial Day through Labor Day, and we would go in the summer, and Guy would always drive the Tempo, his boat, into the Marine Theater. There was a canal between the front and the backstage. He would drive the boat in, he would step off of his boat, lead the pit orchestra in the national anthem, get back on the boat, and you just floor it out of there. And my fondest memories of most of my friends growing up was when Uncle Guy would let us ride in the cabin when he was doing that. And so that was a lot of fun.
How did they choose the members of the band?
The first band, they were all friends from London. And so the band just kept growing in size.
When somebody would leave, what was the audition process like?
You know, I know that, like, the only audition that I was ever told about was when my uncle Kenny Gardner joined the band. And, you know, Guy would hear a musician, and then he would tell the musician he want him to come over and, you know, either audition or just become a member of the band. Kenny, my Aunt Elaine, my aunt, she's Guy's sister, had heard Kenny on the radio, had met him at our music production company, because she was a secretary there. And she said to Guy, you have to hire this man. You have to. And Guy's like, you know, looking at his sister going, yeah, whatever. Well, the next day when they got back to the Roosevelt and were rehearsing, he called over one of the sound check people and said, get me a sample of this Kenny Gardner. And sure enough, Daddy heard it, and he brought Kenny over and hired him on the spot.
What became of Guy's instrument and his red jacket from New Year's Eve?
You know, my Aunt Lilibel survived him, and so I'm not sure what she did with those items. You know,
Is there anything in the collection from the performances of guys?
Not really. You know, they had donated so much. There was a museum up in London that the city started, and my family donated many, many, like, guys' baton, different costumes or whatever, uniforms. One of his speedboats is up there. The museum is now closed, and these items are in storage in London. But so most of the memorabilia such as that was donated by different family members to the museum, and so that's where most of it stays.
You know, it's interesting. I was watching the production there from 1976, and obviously they go to the Waldorf Astoria after the local news, and Guy comes out, and that's a big deal. The band's out there, everybody's in the room. In live time, when you're there, did he come out before that moment, or where was he?
He would be on the stage. He would just be off camera.
And he would just walk out, and huge applause.
Yep.
Huge applause.
Yep.
Did the band play before he came out?
No. No, he would have started the band, and then he would have gone off stage or something like that. But no, he was always there with them.
And when he walked out, being in the room, what was that like?
It was like, you know, it was just kind of so exciting because of his energy. And he just had that glint in his eye and that smile, and you just knew you were going to have a good time.
Did you ever speak to him about being called Mr. New Year's Eve? How did that title come about? Was that just because he did it?
That's because he did it for so long. You know, and early on, I mean, it wasn't even like he did it for so long. It seemed like that just kind of stuck to him after a couple of years of doing it. And, you know, and it just followed him. And all of a sudden, it was just kind of known in society that you were going to dance to Guy Lombardo on New Year's Eve.
And, you know, it's interesting because when I look for a picture, most of them, he's in a party hat. He's got the noisemaker.
Yeah.
It's interesting that he has a great body of work, and thank goodness it's still out there. But first and foremost, I think it's this time of year, New Year's Eve.
It is. It truly is. Because if somebody is going to remember him, especially if they're younger than me, and they're not from New York, because, you know, we Long Islanders knew him very much because he lived there and he loved being there. And so we knew him beyond being Guy Lombardo, the orchestra leader. You know, it's usually, well, New Year's Eve, oh, yeah, I remember doing that at my grandma's house, you know, or something like that. You know, they remember it because of that.
How would he like to have been remembered?
I think he would like to have been remembered for being the band leader that introduced more new songs than anybody else of the day, that he, you know, brought a lot of people along by introducing their songs. He certainly made them famous also. That he was a family man who cared deeply about his family. And, you know, he did not have any children, and neither did my Uncle Carmen, but he cared very deeply about his brothers and his brothers' families and his sisters' families. And I think that's how he'd like to be remembered.
Do you remember the last time you spoke with him or saw him, what he said?
Yeah, we were at Jones Beach, and it was right before they were getting ready to go on the road. And he and I were talking, because at that point, I thought I wanted to kind of go in and start being like a script writer, those type of things. And so we sat down and we talked for probably about 45 minutes about what that entailed and, you know, how I was going to kind of put my mind to it and, you know, what he could do to help me and that type of stuff. And that was the last conversation we had.
And then, of course, shock on here. Where were you when you heard of his passing?
I was at my home, you know, in out on Long Island. And, you know, it was as though somebody had basically just pulled the curtain down on our lives. It was just so unexpected and just so dreadful to hear.
Gina, I think you said it best earlier on. When he died, he took New Year's Eve with him. I know a lot of people feel that way, but thank goodness he lives on records and CDs and on YouTube, where people can still watch him. What a pleasure it is to have this close to New Year's Eve, Gina Lombardo on, the niece of the legendary Mr. New Year's Eve, Guy Lombardo. Thank you, Gina, so much.
Thank you, Scott, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's it for today. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
And start saying what the truth is. That's what they're trying to get out. If they do that, they could get some public restoration of their...